You're listening to the Prepared Homestead Podcast, equipping you to build a self-sufficient homestead in uncertain times.
We're your hosts, Sean and Monica Mitzel, coming to you from Sovereign Sunrise Permafarm in the mountains of northern Idaho. We're glad you're with us.
On today's podcast, Monica and I get a chance to sit down with David Kirshner. He is an author in the post-apocalyptic world genre. So his trilogy that we're going to be talking about today, at least partially, is a dystopian political thriller. And it's very good. I've read the first part, and I'm looking forward to parts two and three. But David is currently working as an analyst and lives with his wife and two children. He was born and raised in the Southeast and spent much of his childhood in the small towns of Northern Virginia and Southern North Carolina. David's previous works include the first three installments of the Foreign and Domestic series, and those are named When Rome Stumbles, Hannibal is at the Gates, and By the Dawn's Early Light. He is also working on a fourth installment for the Foreign and Domestic series called Colder Weather. So we have a very interesting interview coming up. We enjoyed it very much, and I think you will too. Before we get started with Dave, I want to talk about some of the things that are going on around here at the Prepared Homestead. One of the things that's been happening around here is you've been doing a lot of work on the website.
Yes. And it still requires a lot of development. So,
yeah.
Thepreparedhomestead.org. Right. Thepreparedhomestead.org. And I've set up a store. They're putting some of our available products right now. We're working on getting a lot more put in, but... You know, so keep checking back because...
Yeah, we have a lot in the works right now.
Yes.
We're doing a lot of... We're creating courses and doing a lot of writing. Yeah. I think it's going to be very valuable to people.
Yeah, I think so too.
Help out a lot.
Yeah, and so we've got goal setting on there. We have preparing to homestead, and that includes... Both of those include workbooks that can, you know, walk you through either goal setting or if you're getting ready or trying to prepare to homestead. And the other thing that's on there is... the Prepared Homestead Planner and Calendar, which is actually a physical book that...
It's a planner and calendar.
Yes, planner and calendar that we would be sending to you. It's got gardening sections. It has animal tracking your animals and purchases of food and hay and things.
Yeah, it's really designed for homesteaders.
Yes.
It's pretty cool.
It's got an entire planner that you would use as a homesteader.
Awesome. All right, and then... Besides all of that, we have a lot. We're getting into our busy period.
Yeah.
We're starting up kind of workshop season, I guess is a good way to put it. And
The time that people can actually get up our driveway.
And we've been asked. Yeah, exactly. And we've also been asked to speak at some events coming up. So let's talk about that real quick.
Okay.
In March, that's when we're kind of kicking off workshop season.
Mm-hmm.
And we're starting out on March 12th is Water Strategies for the Homestead. This is this is one of my favorite workshops to teach because it's so important, but it's exciting too because I love to develop water in different ways, whether it's springs or ponds or swales or just talking about, you know, how to utilize your well better, conservation, lots of things like that.
Yeah. Well, and March is a really good time for it because hopefully we'll still be getting some moisture. You wait too long and even, you know, things that people could do at home, it's too late.
Yeah, exactly. So. And we implemented a lot of water strategies last year, but we did it in the dry period.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes you have to do that. And if you're going to dig ponds and swales, it's actually better to not do it when it's really wet. But anyway, so March 12th. And then in April, we have three in April.
Yeah, and possibly four. We're talking about adding a fourth. We haven't added it yet, but
right.
You know, these are all available. If you go to thepreparedhomestead.org and you click on calendar, it'll take you to our calendar and all the events that are there. You'll be able to see, just scroll through each of the months and you'll be able to get some details on each one. And it'll give you a link to be able to sign up.
Yep. Awesome. Okay. So April 2nd. Guilds and Food Force. So we walk you through the design and building of Guilds and Food Force. And this year we're actually going to do some hands-on work. We're going to basically plant a small guild. And so the people that are in the workshop can really get some good hands-on.
Yeah.
And then April 16th is small animal husbandry, where we kind of concentrate on chickens, ducks, and rabbits.
Yes.
Basically approaches to raising them and, of course, you know, care and feeding and all those kinds of things. And then the same day, so we have a morning workshop and we have an afternoon workshop, is small animal processing.
Which is actually perfect because if you're wanting to raise small animals, knowing how to process them is a really good skill. When you're living on a homestead, the more you can keep on your homestead rather than farming it out to somebody else to process. We do that for other people, but we prefer to teach people how to do it themselves. And so coming and, you know, getting that animal husbandry in the morning and then in the afternoon, learning how to finish the process.
That's right.
By learning how to butcher them.
Yeah, that is a very important skill to know for sure. And in May, we've been asked to give some presentations. So the first one is May 7th. And that's at the Northwest Preparedness Expo, and that's in Prosser, Washington.
Yes, and we will have a booth there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And then again, May 15th at the Sustainable Preparedness Expo, that one is in Spokane, Washington.
Right.
So we will also have a booth there.
Yeah, we'll have a booth, and both of those you'll be giving a presentation on permaculture for preparedness.
Yes. Other than that, well, we probably should just stop there. That covers kind of April and May.
Yeah.
And, how about we get to the interview? We're going to bring David up right now and, learn all about what he is doing with his book series. And there's much more to it than that. We're not just going to talk to him about his books. It's a great interview. All right. So, hey, Dave, thanks for being with us today. We really appreciate your time. I've gotten a chance to read your first book. We really enjoy it. It was very engaging. One of my favorite genres. And so I'm really looking forward to reading parts 2 and 3. And my understanding is part 4, but we'll get to that. But why don't we start with you telling us a little bit kind of about yourself and really kind of how do you get to this point in life where you're an author, which is so cool.
When I was a kid, I always had a love for writing and research and looking things up and reading and kind of learning about things that were of interest to me that I wasn't necessarily being taught in a public school. I mean, it wasn't part of the regular curriculum, but I was always fascinated by a friend of mine. His family owned a little down south, we refer to it as a gentleman's estate.
Yeah.
Which basically means he had about 30 acres. His father had grown up on a dairy farm in Delaware, but they were land developers. So they just, they kind of had some stupid money.
Right.
And, he would go buy, my wife and I like horses. We're going to go, so he would get two horses and the wife would, they would ride the horses for a couple of years and then their interests would wane. And then they would, they'd go get a bunch of beef cattle and then the cows would be running around the place, we're being kids. We're out there with skeet throwers and potato guns and he'd come yell at us because we're spooking the cattle and, but I always loved being outside and learning. From Boy Scouts, learning about nature, learning about, the primitive camping and survival and stuff like that, that you didn't realize that you were being taught to be a prepper, to be a homesteader, to be self-sufficient when you were going for all of your various merit badges.
Right.
So it just became very, very ingrained in me. And that kind of laid dormant while I was, I was learning a trade. I took a couple years off between high school and college, and I was building, I was a foreman on a construction crew building custom luxury homes down in Pinehurst, North
skill.
Carolina.
That's a good skill to know.
Yeah, that one will get you in the gate when it all goes sideways.
Right.
If you have a tradable skill. So I actually just posted who was I talking to? I don't remember. I was talking to somebody and maybe it was something I put on my Facebook page, but it was about being, you know, being prepared and learning and you know, having some sort of tradable skill. But anyway, to go back to where you wanted me to go, which was...
my job is to derail you as much as possible.
it doesn't take much. My wife claims I have undiagnosed, unmedicated ADHD. So they got me a T-shirt for Christmas. It says, my wife thinks I have ADD, but I don't know what she's... Oh, look, a squirrel. And it's got a picture of a squirrel sitting on there chewing on a nut. And I was like, that's me.
Nice.
you know, my love of the outdoors never went away. You know, I would watch my dad with his grow lights, and he would have you know the burpee delivery every spring, and he'd be trying to grow something new under the grow lights, and it always, you know, I never did anything with it. I would just sit and I would watch him as he was doing that. He would listen to the Washington Redskin games because he was a retired naval commander. And he was, you know, he had his retirement and his pension or whatever, and he would play in the dirt, and he would, you know, and it was just something that I observed. And now that I'm a father, I have two teenage daughters, you know, they see everything.
Yeah.
Yes.
They hear everything. Even if it's just, you know, you're making a snide comment about somebody, they hear it, they internalize it, they think that's okay. And then you wind up spending, you know, 3 weeks correcting behavior. So
all stemming from you.
Usually, yes. They've definitely increased their vocabulary, not in a good way sometimes. when I went to college, I found that I was drawn toward the English classes. I actually wound up in college because of one of the guys on the framing crew. This guy was an ex-con. He had done 10 years for attempted murder in a drug deal going wrong. And he pulled me aside one day and he said, look, man, what are you doing out here? And I was like, building houses. What are you talking about? And he said, you see that guy over there? That guy, he's been building houses for 20 years. And he has never been once approached about being the foreman or the superintendent on a job. He said, you know, how long were you out here before you learned how to read a blueprint? Mm. And I said, I don't know, about 2 months. I got tired of cutting wood and hauling lumber, so I wanted more responsibility. He said, that's the difference.
Yeah.
You have the drive. You have the ambition. That guy over there, he's a third-generation carpenter. He's been out here for 15 years, and you already make more money than he does. You know more than he does. He might have more experience than you and have more ways to solve a problem than you do, but you've already surpassed him in what he's capable of doing.
Mm.
He said, I'll tell you what, if you're not signed up for night school and heading off to college, I'm going to kill you.
And you can take that guy seriously.
I took him seriously. His name was Ted Bryant, and he was one of the main motivators to go back to college. But I also met my wife, and we had gotten engaged, and she said yes. And she said, I said, well, when do you want to get married? She said, we're not getting married until you graduate from college. So, I mean, so she was putting conditions on from the beginning, but,
another
she's
motivator.
Still putting conditions on. But anyway, while I was in college, I found that I was drawn toward these English language classes. Literacy, grammar, creative writing. But one of the classes that I had to take, and I remember this like it was yesterday, I had to take a poetry class. Now, I went to school in the mountains of North Carolina at Appalachian State University. And it was full of very earthy people. And I say it that way because I can't think of a better way to describe them. These were kids that were of privilege that had gone off to college. They would grow dreadlocks for 9 months while they were home or while they were away from home. And you could always tell when summer was coming up because all the guys suddenly had no hair.
Yeah.
Because they were not going to go home with dreadlocks and cornrows. And, you know, but everything smelled of patchouli. And, okay. You know, when you're up there in the mountains and it's cold and the school's in a valley and you've got a wind, a snowstorm coming and they don't open the windows and it gets very difficult to attend class. But I had to take this poetry class and I liked the epic poems, you know, from Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey and other classics like Beowulf, and you had Shakespeare and stuff like that. But then I wound up stuck in this poetry class, and I wound up writing this long poem. It was like Beowulf versus the Highlander or something like that. And the teacher was like, I don't know, you need to not be in this class. You need to take the creative writing classes and stuff like that. And so that's kind of where it grew from. My degree is in English with a specialization in technical communications, which allows me to be a tech writer and a technical analyst. So I kind of help define how systems are supposed to function, to put it in, you know, lay terms. But
right.
I wound up writing books when I was summarily laid off with about 150 people over three different rounds of layoffs, and I took a cooking class.
Nice.
And the instructor and I hit it off really well. We're both of similar personality, so when he and I get together, nobody else gets to talk. He and I, you know, he'll talk, but if he pauses and takes a breath, I'll take over, and blah, 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 you know, and that's kind of where the first book, the nonfiction book, came from. It was all about cooking and having small gatherings and entertaining small groups of friends and family, kind of in the tradition of, you know, it's like a Thanksgiving or a Christmas or an Easter, but it's much less formal. You know, it's, hey, you know, I grew these vegetables, or, you know, I want to try this recipe, or, you know, it's so-and-so, you know, it's whatever the reason is, whatever the occasion is. It's kind of where that book came from.
Okay, so then what moved you from more of the technical writing into a fictional writing? Because that's very different.
The research. The research led me down that path. I have a neighbor across the street. He's got twin boys the same age as my oldest daughter, and one of them is autistic. Hmm. And then there was a young child down the street who was severely autistic. Hmm. And, you know, numerous family members had been befallen with various forms of cancer. Or I had neighbors that had, you know, odd gastrointestinal issues. So I started doing research when I was writing the nonfiction cooking entertainment book. And I was learning all this stuff about the food industry. I was reading books by researchers like Michael Pollan. My daughter's actually brought home a children's edition, of one of his books. And you know, I was kind of reading through it, seeing, you know, what are they being taught? How is this part of their curriculum? And come to find out, the reason that the teacher assigned it is because it was very personal to her, because she had had breast cancer and gone through a double mastectomy. Mm. And one of the things the doctors had told her was that the breast cancer was not something that was prevalent in her bloodline, in her family, either on her mother or her father's side. So they started looking at her diet. And that, you know, I squirreled that conversation away. And my chef friend had me do a little experiment. You'll believe it or not, I did an experiment with cheese. He said, buy a bag of, you know, shredded cheddar, or, you know, whatever you want, and then buy a block of the same type of cheese and shred it yourself. Put that in equal pots over equal heat on an equal size burner and stir, stir, stir. And then tell me if you can get the lumps out of each of the pots. And I thought, well, that's That's just crazy, dude. It's cheese. You know, there was a very animated conversation between the two of us. And I was like, fine, I'll go do your stupid cheese experiment. You know? And about 2-3 weeks later, I did it. And I called him up in a panic. I was just beside myself. I couldn't figure it out. I was like, dude, what? I don't get it. You know, my wife has taken the pot of cheese that I had shredded myself. And she had poured that into a bowl, called the girls down, and they got out a bag of chips because they like nothing more than nachos. They love nachos. And I was like, you can't eat this one. I don't know what's in this one. There's something in this, you know.
Anti-caking agent.
Correct. It's the anti-caking agent. It's additives. It's preservatives. It's basically, it's all the stuff your body has no idea what to do with.
Yep.
And in return, when you ingest it, your body does one of two things. The body either says, I don't know what that is, you're out of here. Or it says, I don't know what that is, but I think I might be able to figure that out. I'm going to tuck it away over here. Mm. And it does the same thing with a lot of ingredients in your soda. And what they found is that when you have so much of a processed ingredients, your body has started tucking that away, and then all of a sudden that becomes a mass. Mm-hmm. And then that can lead to other issues, whether it's, you know, intestinal blockage, or, you know, in some cases it becomes a tumor, in some cases it becomes a colon problem. You know, so I was like, no way, there's no way. Why are they putting this stuff in our food? And then I got that book that my daughter brought home, and I was reading the introduction, and he was talking about how commercial potatoes are grown. Mm. And what he basically outlined was that the potatoes are grown in a large field, and they have a circular mechanism or apparatus that will spray the fields periodically, they'll water them, what have you. But when they get to the point where they're about ready to harvest, they'll spray a chemical out there in the field. And if that mechanism fails for any reason, it is not safe for a human to walk into that field for at least 5 days.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And they just sprayed that on your potato.
Right.
It's leaking into the ground. The potatoes are absorbing it. The plants are absorbing it. The roots are sucking it all up. And if nothing goes wrong, you know, they'll go in, they'll harvest those potatoes, but that chemical that they've sprayed has a half-life of about 6 months before it reduces down to a level that is deemed
acceptable,
suitable for human consumption. Mm-hmm. So they harvest all these potatoes, they put them in a large underground, you know, potato barn storage area, and then you've got, you know, then they just sit there and wait, and, you know, that's what's in your Happy Meal.
Right, yeah.
You know, that's – so, you know, I was becoming more and more disgusted with the alphabet soup that was, you know, saying, yeah, this stuff's fine. This stuff will be okay.
Right.
But then I started learning about rates of incidence for neurological and gastrointestinal – issues. And, you know, I started with where my mom had Alzheimer's. My dad died of pancreatic cancer. My neighbor's got celiac disease. My neighbor across the street's got the son with autism. He's got a father with, you know, Alzheimer's. He's got a brother who's bipolar, you know. And I was trying to slake my own appetite for knowledge. I had no idea that this was going to turn into a book. We live in a pretty tight-knit neighborhood. So a lot of the guys will get together, me, a neighbor and I in particular, every Wednesday night. And, you know, we've coined it as Carnage Night. So we'll play like first person shooter games. We'll go see the latest blockbuster, shoot 'em up movie. You know, we'll do all the stuff our wives have no interest in doing with us. Okay. You know, and we even have a nickname for when we have projects. It's called Man Town. So like I needed to replace the front step on my porch. I was like, I've never made a front step. I've never played with concrete before. And he was like, well, I'm on my way over. We're going to figure this out, you know. And so we got the name Man Town, right?
Right.
Or I put in a privacy fence in my backyard, and he was like, I'll be right over. We're playing with chainsaws and post hole diggers. This is going to be awesome, you know. And, you know, so we started doing these things, and he is a huge post-apocalyptic fiction fan. So he got me into things like The Walking Dead, and then there was a TV show called Revolution, and then there was another one before that called Jericho.
That was great.
And I was hooked. I was completely fascinated. And then he recommended some books, and then as I worked my way through the genre, you know, reading guys like Rawls and Forkston and Tate and Joe Nobody and all these guys, right? So some of them, you know, they wrote things that were a little out there for me, or they wrote things that I wasn't able to connect with because I didn't have the requisite background to really understand what they were saying. But, you know, when it came to the relationships, the story arcs, the food, the preparedness and understanding, you know, it might be a good idea to have a couple months worth of food on hand. It might be a good idea to have, you know, a way to filter water. It might be a good idea to have, you know,
weapons to fight zombies.
Yeah. Band-aids, bullets, and beans. you know, so I started looking around. And I was like, you know what? We live in an area that loses power a lot. You know, we had a windstorm in 07, and it knocked out power for a week.
Oh, wow.
We had a snowstorm that came through in 02, and, you know, lost power for a week. You know, those are two incidents that I know the actual year of, but there's been plenty of them in between. But
right, yeah.
You know, and it was like, I don't want to have to go get a hotel room. I want to stay in my house.
Right.
And, you know, how that, you know, those incidents are inconveniences. You know, now yep. What happens, you know, what do I need to do if there's something that lasts a little longer? You know, so I started doing more and more research during the course of that research, I came across GMOs. And I was like, and my wife is a biologist. She has a degree in cellular biology. And she teaches high school biology, and she's AP and IB certified. And, you know, and I was coming across all this stuff, and I was like, you know, I would come running into the room with my little iPad or my laptop or whatever book I had bought. I was like, do you see this? Do you want?
And what was her reaction?
And then it clicked. I now had something tangible in my mind that I could tie back to all the research that I had done about rates of incidence. Because what I was finding was that Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia, even multiple sclerosis, they were all on the uptick. And autism, gastrointestinal, foodborne allergies, all this stuff. And what I was seeing was that in the mid to late 90s, early 2000s, all these things started just going up and up, and they just were skyrocketing on all these charts. And I was like, that's it. It's all the GMO's fault, you know? And I just, and that's kind of where the books came from was, you know, I got to tell somebody.
Yeah.
They need to know this stuff, you know? And I was doing a lot of digging. It took a while to find some of this information. And I was like, I got to figure out, you know, I got to do something. And meanwhile, I had written the nonfiction book, and I was reading all the paw fiction, and I was really enjoying those. And I was like, you know what? I can go into any bookstore. I can go on to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or, you know, any one of these online retailers, and I can find a book in this genre that deals with EMP, that deals with financial collapse, that deals to a degree with some sort of terrorist attack of some kind, or you know, a solar flare. You know, those are the big ones.
Yeah.
But what I wasn't finding was a book that showed how a nation could crumble if the food system was disrupted.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
So I started with a simple premise of trying to answer my own question of what would it take to remove GMOs from our food chain? Hmm. And the only thing that I could come up with that seemed plausible was linking them irrefutably to cancer, gastrointestinal problems, neurological problems. And I thought, well, okay, that was, you know, that took me a grand total of about 45 seconds to come up with that answer.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became, well, would the American people do anything about it? Would they even care? Would, you know, if they came up with empirical data that said, you know, too much of this is going to lead to this, or too much of that is going to lead to all of these other things. You know, because a lot of this information is starting to come out, and I'm not even having to stretch my imagination. I can just read the news.
Right.
Yeah.
So I said, well, if I'm able to make that link fictionally, so I don't get sued for libel.
Right.
Because nobody wants that. You can have half of what I got, which is nothing. So, you know, but I like my house. You know, I need my car, and to a degree, I could ride a bus, I guess. But, you know, if I link GMOs to all of these issues, and somebody in the alphabet soup is going to do something about it, what could they do? And so the second question was, what would it take to remove GMOs was question one. Question two is, what would it look like if we removed GMOs from our food chain abruptly?
Hmm. Yeah.
That would be.
Well, I think the question there, I mean, it's a great question, but if I think even a bigger question that is nested in is, what would happen if our current big food system collapsed, you know, from any number of reasons. It could be transportation, or, you know, pesticides no longer effective, you know, whatever, GMOs, et cetera. So, I mean, it's a great question. What would you say to the person who says, like, look, I get it. I clearly see all of the upticks in everything you mentioned, from A to Z, from food allergies to cancer. It's clearly there, but we cannot clearly define or, you know, pinpointed on GMOs. It's because we live in a toxic society. What would you say to that?
I would say that there, you can't escape it unless you do something like your life have done. Or I would say that the people that are probably the safest and furthest removed from it are the ones that lead a completely self-sufficient homesteading lifestyle.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And by that, I mean, you know where the trees in your orchard came from. And either, you know, you grew them from seed yourself, or you got for the trees when you have the saplings?
The grafting.
Grafting, thank you. You grafted something that you knew the source. You know how to garden on a micro scale, but enough for you and maybe some extended family, or for barter, or for, you know, a farmer's market of some kind. But you know how to harvest seed, you know how to store that seed, you know how to propagate the plants if, you know, something happens, and, you know, maybe your bee colony, your beehives that you've been using for honey, and the bees aren't doing their thing because they got into some bad fields and they got some BT corn or something and it knocked off all the bees again. Hmm. The ones that are able to be as self-sufficient as possible, you know, their cows, their sheep, their lamb, their goats, they're all just kind of roaming around. They're grass-fed. The vet shows up to make sure that they're in good health, but they're not sticking them with a needle.
Right.
They're not injecting anything into them. Those are the ones that are going to be better off than, you know, the ones that are in the cities or that are in, you know, even in suburbia where I'm at. I have my own garden. I grow a large amount of vegetables. I've learned how to can. I've learned how to dehydrate. I've learned how to store things long term. I'm always expanding the garden and looking to grow new things. So I've got a bit of a head start on, you know, on many of my neighbors in that regard. But, you know, do I make my own bread from scratch using yeast that I have cultivated and grown and maintained so that I can avoid the grocery store bought loaf of bread that maybe was grown nearby some GMO fields or contains GMO ingredients? You know, I don't grow my own wheat.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't have a means to grind my own flour from my own crop. So it really comes down to, you know, having the land available that would allow you to be that self-sufficient. But I don't even know if that would be possible because, you've got winter wheat, you've got spring wheat, you've got oats. People are going to, you know, your livestock, you know, you got to feed them. You got to have enough room for all that. You got to have enough room for your garden. You got to have, you know, you got to collect your own rainwater, and, you know, because you don't want to be on city water, or, you know, the well water might be safe enough, but you never know. You know, in my area, there's a lot of fracking.
Hmm.
I don't know if I want well water because the big oil companies that are coming in here and doing the shale gas and they're doing the fracking, they won't tell the general public what's in the chemical formula being used to bring the natural gas to the surface.
Right.
So I don't know that I want a well. You know, so, and then you've got the middle of the country. There's, you know, there's going to be a change of president, thankfully, in the next, I can't even start, but I get all worked up, but,
yeah. It's been a disaster, but you know, one thing that we can almost guarantee is it's not going to change. You know, one person coming in is not going to fix our problem.
No, you're absolutely right. But hopefully they can, you know, start fixing a lot of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's no silver bullet. There's no one size fits all. It's going to take a while to undo a lot of the damage, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. We try and teach people. One of our big things is, you know, working towards self-sufficiency is great, and we obviously promote that as homesteaders. But what we really drive towards is self-sufficiency within a community, you know, because just like you said, you know, we don't grow our own grains, actually. But we grow, we raise all of our own animals, and we've got, you know, big gardens, and we've got food forests, and et cetera, et cetera. But we, you know, the bottom line is we're not going to be 100% self-sufficient. Yeah, maybe we could eke out a survival living.
We could. We'd have to sacrifice a child or two, but you know.
Yeah.
Well, that's just one less mouth to feed. Exactly. Now you're over the top.
Right. Yeah.
We have four teenagers still at home, so you know they're big eaters. You gotta whittle that down.
Right.
Yeah. I was the third of four sons in a military family with a stay-at-home mom.
Nice.
Okay.
They would take us to the commissary on the base, and each kid would get a shopping cart that's the same size as the today's Sam's Club cart. You know, those super giant mm-hmm. big ones.
Yeah.
And we would fill all four of them. Each kid would have their own cart, and they would walk out of there, and the bill was $250.
Nice. Can't even imagine.
You know, late 70s, early 80s. Now, if you did that, that bill would be about $700.
Oh, probably more. Probably more, yeah. More over 1,000.
Yeah, they honestly had, my parents had a chest freezer that was 6 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had an upright freezer. And they would buy 2 dozen loaves of bread. They'd put one loaf in the kitchen. They'd put the other 23 in the freezer. They would buy 2 dozen gallons of milk. Put one in the house, the other 23 out in the freezer. And then they'd make you cut it. So you would have, and they had color coordinated pitchers. So you had a white pitcher for milk, obviously, and you would pour a half gallon of milk into the white pitcher, and then you'd fill the rest of it with water, and then you'd put in one scoop of powdered milk. And that's how they made 24 gallons of milk stretch an entire month with four sons.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
To this day, I hate milk. All of my brothers are 6'1 or better. And I came in at a shade under at 5'11 and 3/4. My mom would measure us on the first day of high school and the last day of high school. And I came in at 5'11 and 3/4. And I swear to you, I never got that extra quarter inch. And I think it was because I hated the milk so much, I refused to drink it.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's a good calorie filler.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah, I mean, my brothers, they would drink it like it was water. I was like, I'm not touching it. It's horrible. I can't do it. Where's the orange juice? You know. So, but to better answer your question regarding what you can do, you can limit your exposure by paying attention.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Reading labels. You know, a lot of the people that are on my side of the political spectrum, you know, aren't necessarily in alignment with me when it comes to labeling. They feel that that's a, you know, a democratic cause. You know, that hurts big ag, that hurts commercial farmers, and I'm thinking it doesn't hurt anybody to label it so that people know what they're ingesting.
Right.
You know, because they're going to go on thinking this is all safe. You know, that's what they told us about Calphalon. How many hundreds of thousands of people got cancer because the chemical formula for Calphalon was wrong?
Right.
The same thing was true for, you know, when people started being able to purchase canned goods. I mean, after World War II and in the 50s, I mean, they made leaps and bounds when it came to prepackaged foods, pre-canned items, you know, no more Victory Gardens. You don't have to shell peas anymore. You know, you can just go to the freezer and buy a whole bag of them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, but what they didn't tell us was that the lining inside the cans, that's why they would tell you, don't ever buy a dented can. It'll kill you.
Mm.
Because it was true back then. Now you can go buy a dented can for a penny and everybody's fine, because the liners had a liquid inside it between the liner and the can. Wow. And it was like this gelatinous goo.
Ew.
And you wouldn't know it. It would just mix and co-mingle with the ingredients in the can. And so you would make your cup of soup, or you would make, you know, green beans or, you know, corn or whatever. And everything was coated in the goo.
Right.
And people were getting cancer, and they were like, hey, wait a minute, what's going on here?
Yeah. It's kind of like any number of pharmaceutical drugs that have been pulled from the market after all these, you know, heart attacks, et cetera, et cetera. But hey, guess what? We have a new drug and it's totally safe.
And then you got the guy that talks 120 miles an hour and tells you about all the things that are going to go wrong with, you know.
And the last one is death.
Yeah. You know, they, I don't know if you guys watched the Super Bowl.
No.
But they had drug commercials during the Super Bowl.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And it was, you know, some kind of a bowel drug. And people were looking at this going, this is the Super Bowl, and they just put a drug on there for bowel problems. And people were like, what is going on? You know, it used to be, you know, the doctors knew. The doctors went to the med school. They went to grad school. They did their internships. They did their residency. You know, they, if you wanted a doctor that was going to prescribe homeopathic remedies, you could go find one.
Yep.
If you wanted a doctor that was going to give your kids Zoloft because of their, you know, depression, you'd go find one of those too. But now you've got WebMD. You've got Big Pharma running around. They've got billboards. They've got TV commercials. They've convinced – this is – the United States is the most heavily drugged country on the planet.
Yeah. They've got and all the educational institutions as well.
Yeah, and when I have – you know, because of the industry that I work in IT, I work with a lot of people from different countries. And, you know, they're here on H-1Bs. They're working toward their green card. Some of them have been here long enough that they've gone through the green card process and they now have their citizenship. And, you know, when the people first come over from, you know, Western Europe, from Eastern Europe, from, you know, Asia, they're all astounded. They're usually one of their first questions is, you know, are all these people on these drugs? You know, you would think that the United States had a breeding problem with the number of drugs that they have for men. And it's everywhere. It's prevalent. I was watching a TV show with my daughter, and I had to quickly change the channel. This was a couple years ago. I had to quickly change the channel because I did not want to have to explain to my 8-year-old daughter what ED was.
Right.
I'm like, that's not even remotely appropriate.
Right.
You know, why is that on you know, the Disney Channel?
Oh, my.
Yeah. You know, and now, you know, both of them are into middle school and in their teenage years. And it just – the stuff that I hear and I see, you know, a lot – that's why I wrote – a character, my main character, my protagonist in the series, is anti-technology.
Mm. Yeah, you're talking about Josh, right?
Yeah, Josh. Josh, he's living a semi-homesteading type of life. He doesn't have a computer. He got rid of his TV, you know, because. And that was really kind of me coming through that character, because I was so sick of technology and being constantly bombarded with, whether it's negative political ads, it's drug commercials, you know, entertainers, quote unquote, you know, whether that's the left coast, you know, movie stars or the professional athletes, you know, they were always doing something nefarious. They were always, you know, they would do something. And you're looking at this going, who's raising my child? Is it me or is it this idiot who, you know, threw half the country and their beliefs under the bus because she wants to impress her Hollywood crowd? And I was like, that's it. I'm done. I'm out. You know?
Yeah.
and so you'll see in just about every character in the series has some aspect of my personality, and, you know, for better or for worse, unfortunately.
Yeah.
you guys said that you had read When Rome Stumbles, so you know you got an idea of where I might be heading with, you know, you had alluded to that, you know, it was more about a community.
Yeah.
And I was glad that you mentioned that because that's kind of what my character is doing. You know, he's reading the signs. He's seeing what's out there. You know, he's not turned a blind eye and a deaf ear to what's out there. He's just choosing how much he's willing to be exposed to. But he has been keeping an eye. It's one of the reasons why he bought the farm and one of the reasons why he's out in the middle of nowhere. He knows, look, man, Prozac Nation is going to go down the tubes in a heartbeat if something happens, whether that's, you know, we've just had four straight days of losses on Wall Street.
Yep.
You know, I remember that would cause a panic. People would be freaking out. Now it's like, oh, we only lost 300 today? Okay, no problem. Yeah.
Squirrel.
Yeah, no kidding. Hey, what's going on in Washington? Hey, so-and-so's dating so-and-so. And on, mm-hmm. you know, the E! Channel, you're like, oh. You know? But, you know, it just – a lot of my personality, a lot of my issues, a lot of my preferences, a lot of my thoughts come through not just the protagonist but also some of the other characters too that are, you know, friends and family and colleagues. And so,
yeah,
you know, I could talk for hours. What else you got?
No, that's – I mean, it's very cool. You can definitely sense that in your reading. Now I want to shift gears just a little bit. As a former military officer, I was very much trained in, you know, doing planning and operations, and I would often do strategic plans and you know, build operational plans and things like that, and I would do center of gravity analysis, and I would.
You're not really James Wesley Rawls, are
you? No, and I would look at what are the critical vulnerabilities of in both the friendly situation and the enemy situation and all these things. So I want to ask you this question because you alluded to it earlier, and I want to talk about our food system because we definitely have our thoughts on the subject. But what do you see as the critical vulnerabilities in our food system? And you know, we could talk about big food, big ag, you know, big government, and how that revolving door. But what do you see as those critical vulnerabilities?
where to start?
Yeah, I know.
I think
it's an important subject.
Yeah, but I think that one of the key critical vulnerabilities to not only big ag, but a large amount of the alphabet soups and how they go about instituting policy is the fact that everybody is globally connected.
Mm-hmm.
So what I mean by that is there might be too much rain in Russia, and so their wheat crop is gone. So now there's a wheat shortage, whereas it used to only affect Eastern Europe.
Yep.
Now, because of the commercialization of the food industry globally, it can't just affect that one nation. There's a ripple effect that goes through everything.
Right.
And that was one of the things that I was kind of drawn to in writing the book, was that, hey, look, man, we're going to get rid of GMOs. Well, you know, we export so many millions of tons to other countries. We can't just arbitrarily not grow this food. We can't just arbitrarily burn the fields because we suddenly decide GMOs are bad.
Right.
But, you know, you've got a global economy where 92% of the corn grown around the world is a GMO crop.
Yep.
Yeah. I think soybeans are up there too, right?
Soybeans up there. Cotton is up there now.
Yeah. Oh, and there. Salmon.
You know, oh, I saw that. I was like, you've got to be kidding. you know, at least you're close enough to the, you know, Pacific Northwest. You could maybe drive out there and get you one yeah. out of the river and be better off. But, you know, but so you have the globalization of the food market, of all of it. That's its major critical vulnerability. But you also have, and this is more, it's a critical vulnerability, but it's also kind of added value is global connectivity as well. Because if one of the federal agencies goes in and, you know, they're doing this in Virginia now, the EPA is going in and grabbing land along the Chesapeake Bay, even though they've cleaned up the waters so that the water's cleaner now than it was in the 1940s. You know, they're going in, they're doing land grabs. But I wouldn't have known that. Not in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, or 90s, or even maybe in the 2000s.
Right.
But because of technology, Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, I've got bloggers, I've got tweeters, I've got podcasts, I've got, you know, some dude with a Best Buy camera who right. can upload a video to YouTube. So the companies can't get away with as much as they used to. There's a greater degree of policing by the citizenry, which is pushing healthier foods. You know, countries are starting, and most of Western Europe has already banned GMOs because they consider them to be abominations. You know, it just, the GMO companies are, you know, they're taking crops from farmers who weren't growing their seed. But because corn is an open air fertilizing plant, meaning the wind has to fertilize and blow the stuff around,
right?
Blow the pollen around. If that blows into a farmer's field who's not growing a GMO crop, the GMO company can go in and take his harvest. Right. Well, it blew over there, and that's happening in Western Canada, not far from you.
Yeah, yeah, it's just it's outrageous.
They also have, the GMO companies have end user license agreements that prohibit the testing of their seeds. So you're not allowed to know what gene sequences were altered, doctored, amended, what was removed, what was added. So that tomato seed that was in that packet that you bought at Lowe's or Home Depot, you know, you're not going to harvest that seed come fall, because the whole problem with a GMO seed is it's mutant. You have to go buy a new seed every year. That's how they're still in business. You can't propagate a new plant from a harvested seed because it's a mutant.
Right.
So, you know, they've put things into plants that are, you know, from a jellyfish, from a puffer fish. They've injected its own enzymes so that it'll secrete its own pesticide, herbicide, fertilizer, you know, you name it. And that's something that we're putting in our bodies. So the critical vulnerabilities for a large number of things actually is the global connectivity of and technology.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I kind of went a long way to get to that.
No, that's
okay. Three little words.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're exactly right. I would add, you know, just in time inventory, and there's many other aspects to this that make it very vulnerable. That it's amazing that the thing has managed to stand for as long as it has.
Yeah. So obviously you took a real interest in food, and that kind of drove, you know, your book series. So what are you trying to do in the near future with the books, and, you know, what kind of subjects are you looking at now?
Now I'm actually going to start playing around in your wheelhouse in terms of homesteading, self-sufficiency. I don't want to give away any spoilers,
okay.
But it's really hard to do because, you know, you guys have read, Sean and Monica, you guys have read part one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've kind of got an idea on my writing style because of, you know, my undiagnosed, unmedicated ADD. You know, I'll have a 15-page chapter. And in that chapter, I'll have, you know, three storylines, and each one of them is 5 pages. And you can see that through the little triple asterisks, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
But by the time you got to the end of that book, I had introduced some storylines that drive parts 2 and 3.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's as much as I can say without ruining for you as you guys read parts 2 and 3.
Okay.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, yeah.
So by the time you get to the end of part 3, all of those story arcs have come to a conclusion.
Okay. So then part four is going to
deal more with your primitive survival skills.
Okay.
Okay. Well, good.
So I'm kind of going back to basics, back to the things that I learned as a child. Back to the things that I learned early on in my research about, you know, self-sufficiency, but now I'm coupling my love of other authors like McCormick, who wrote The Road, and you've got The Postman, and you've got these other post-apocalyptic type of scenarios where something bad has happened, so now people are kind of trying to make do. So you take my love of history and you say, okay, you know, how did people make do when the Revolutionary War was going on?
Mm.
Where'd they get their food from? You know, all the way up through the Industrial Revolution when people started leaving the farm,
mm-hmm,
and going to the city. So now we've had a series of events that, you know, people have left the city because they didn't want to wind up in the gutter, bleeding.
Yeah.
Bad things have happened.
Yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, I've it's difficult to write some of the pieces because you have to go to a very dark place.
Mm.
Yeah.
To come up with some of the scenarios, you know, when you start reading government papers on what they think might happen in terms of the population effects from an EMP.
Yeah, it's staggering. Yeah. It's almost unbelievable when you read the research.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't want to, you know, be a buzzkill on your podcast, so I won't go into it. But there's a spot or two in both 2 and 3 where, you know, I kind of explain where, you know, what you might expect. You know, like we've already talked about, you know, this is the most heavily medicated country on the planet. Now imagine there's no electricity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now imagine you cannot get your meds, you know, if you're depressed, if you're bipolar, you're schizophrenic. Now you got all those guys running around off their meds.
Yeah.
And then in the more tragic vein, do you know anybody that's diabetic and insulin dependent?
Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah.
You know, you got about 6 weeks, you know,
because
that's about how long your insulin's going to last. You know, your family members that are professional travelers, if you're in an airplane and that thing goes off,
right?
You know, and so you kind of get the idea, but you know, I don't treat that subject with any kind of macabre sense of humor or anything. It's just, you know, here are the facts. Here's what, you know, our own government is going to say. But you know, you got to weave that into the narrative. You got to weave that into some sort of conversation. You can't just start throwing stats and stuff out there. So
right.
Those types of things become very, very difficult. But we've had that event So in parts four and on, what I actually did in part four was I fast forwarded 20 years.
Okay.
So we've had, I want to say it, but I can't say it.
You can't say it.
Okay, fast-moving zombies or slow-moving zombies? I'm just kidding.
No zombies, but you get, there's a, you know, there's an element of a New World Order, UN type of thing.
That's cool.
So we've got to deal with that. We've got a number of things, but I take two of the characters, and instead of the main character being Josh and his family, I take two other characters and I make them kind of the focus, and their goal is to get back to Josh.
Okay.
Because that's where their story begins and that's where their story needs to end. So, you know, I've got this set up. It's a lot of the primitive skills, doing lean-tos, tracking, harvesting meat, curing meat in a smokehouse, and being able to have that sense of community after kind of a trinity of horrible things.
Very cool. That sounds great.
When you get to the end of part three, you'll go, I know what he's going to do. You know?
Yeah.
So.
No, that's really cool. I mean, that's, you know, we try and help people towards self-sufficiency, like we said, and build skills. You know, at the same time, we live our lives. We don't live in fear. All those kinds of things. But I think there's some real benefit to this type of fictional writing that kind of helps people move along and helps them come to conclusions and just helps kind of frame their thinking.
Exactly. And that's kind of, that was kind of one of the goals was, you know, I learned so much and I had this great story, you know, and it was rambling around in my head. And I sat down and I started writing it and I was like, there is no way this is going to fit in a book, in one book, unless I make it like Harry Potter,
yeah.
You know, with a really small font size. And, you know, I said, this is not going to work. So that's where the trilogy came from. And then I got to the end of the trilogy and I was like, rats,
I'm not done.
You know, I'm gonna have to make this four or five or six books.
And, yeah.
But the within each book, I try to convey some sort of teaching, learning moment. Whether that's, you know, understanding how a root cellar works, understanding how to, you know, break down an animal that you've harvested in the wild. Understanding how to, you know, maybe make your own bread using yeast water instead of trying to grow and maintain your own ball of yeast and, you know, in a warm space in the corner of your kitchen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
To a lesser degree, because I don't have the background in it, and you may have noticed this in book one, Sean, because you have that military background, you know, my brother is active duty in the Army. And so I would spend, you know, an hour on the phone. Okay, so I've got this scene and I want to do this. And I wanted, and he was like, you're an idiot. Why would you do that? You know? And I was like, well, I was reading, you know, cause I didn't know what else to do. So I bought these, you know, the U.S. military manuals and stuff. You know, he was giving me all kinds of books that he was getting out of the various training classes, and you know, insurgent measures and countermeasure. You know, I was like, okay, so I made this L-shaped, you know, kill box, and he was like, all right, you might be onto something with that one. Where are you going with that? You know, you know. So because I don't have that, what you find in my books is that it's a lot of interpersonal connections. It's a lot of community. It's less military oriented than, say, Rawls.
Right.
But it's more community oriented, like Forkston, who had his books were set up on in Black Mountain in North Carolina, I believe. So I tried to have that balance, you know, because my character is a former military, former Marine. So I had to have, you know, he's going to know some tactics. He's going to, you know, so, but the author who's writing it doesn't. So I'm like, oh man, I got to do some more. Hey, where's my brother? You know, and I call him and he, you know, he's in Guam. I'm like, what are you doing in Guam? You know? And so now I'm asking him questions via email and, you know, so it takes a while to get some of these things written, but within each book, I try to include as many things as I can that teach people how to do something.
Yeah.
Not like as a nonfiction user guide, how to DIY type of scene.
Right.
Or situation, but to give them enough information that they go, hey, that's not a bad idea.
Right.
And in the back of the book, and in all of the books actually, is a useful resources section.
Yeah.
And I kind of use that as like a bibliography. Like I had just written a research paper because I was like, you know, people are going to ask questions. People are going to want to know where to find some of this stuff. People are going to want to know what my source material was. Now, you know, so in the first book, I broke it all down into individual little sections. You know, here's what I learned. Here's what I used for my EMP. Here's what I used for the railroad. Here's what I used for X, Y, or Z, so that people could go and go look and see where I pulled that information from. But I mean, knowing that, you know, I wrote a fictional piece, so I most likely have, you know, changed some aspect of that teachable moment to fit my storyline. But you can go read the unedited, unadulterated versions so that you can understand, you know. Like, for example, during World War II, there was gas shortages, rubber shortages. So people had to make do, but they still had to get around. So what you found was a lot of people had fashioned gasifiers.
Right, wood gasifiers.
Wood gasifiers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a reader because my email address is in the first page. You know, it's the DJK Publishing House at gmail.com. And I put that in the book. You know, just because I knew the genre that I was working in, they like access to the writer, to the author.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they like it when people are responsive. So I had this one gentleman. He was like, he was up in the mountains. I believe he was in West Virginia, and he was like, "Hey, I remember when my daddy, you know, would tell me about, you know, cruising around in a gasifier that was in the sidecar of a motorcycle." And that got me to thinking, and I was like, wait, I've read a book that had that very premise in it. And it was called like, The Hornet Flight or something like that. And it takes place in Western Europe during World War II. And so I remembered that. So I went and found the book and I went and reread that. And then I did a bunch of research on gasifiers and I was like, man, I can actually download PDF blueprints. Okay, save that URL, put that in the back of the book so that, you know, if somebody were so inclined, you know, if you're living off-grid, if you're homesteading, and you need to generate some form of locomotion, whether that's to turn a belt on a wood mill or, you know, on a water pump or something like that, or you wanted to put it in the sidecar of a motorcycle or put it in the back of a truck or whatever, you know, here are the blueprints. Go download them. Go read all about it. But I have to balance what I'm learning and the story so that I give them enough information so that they go, oh, okay, yeah, I get you. I understand. Or I give you enough information that you go, wow, I like the way he solved that. I want to go learn some more about that or XYZ. So that's why I put those things in the back of the book to try and give people a bit of a head start when it comes to their research.
Yeah, no, that's really good. In fact, we interviewed, have you heard of Mike Lister? If I remember his name correctly. Anyway,
it sounds familiar. I'm thinking, but it sounds familiar.
Yeah, he builds gasifiers. He's out here in the Northwest, and you see it running.
Is
into
he really James Wesley Rawls?
Maybe.
I'm convinced everybody out there knows that guy, and they all live next door to him. And you know.
Well, yeah, we can't tell you that, but
I know. That's the tragedy of it all.
Well, hey, Dave, that's really cool. We appreciate you taking the time here today. How can people get a hold of your books?
They can go on to Amazon and just do a search for my name, David Kirshner. That's K-E-R-S-H-N-E-R. There's no C. There's no I. Everybody always butchers it, but it's it's just regular Kirshner.
Got it.
With ease. All four of the books will come up. The cooking and entertainment book plus the three fictional books, they'll come up. You can buy those in PDF, or I'm sorry, in Kindle format, or you can buy them in. I said PDF because I was looking on your blog, and the lady had that you had interviewed about homesteading, and she wrote this PDF file that you could download.
Yeah.
And I was like, ooh, I'm going to get that right before I came on with the phone. So that's why PDF stuck in my head. But yeah, you can get to the Kindle versions and the paperback versions. You can actually get all three books of the foreign and domestic series for less than $5.
Oh, wow.
Because the first two are 99 cents and the most recent one is $1.99 or $2.99. I can't remember which.
Great.
You can do that. I also, as I'm doing my research, my mother-in-law, God bless her. She harangued me for about 6 months because she was finding that authors were creating their own author pages on Facebook.
Right.
And so she was like, you really need to do that. And you know, she just would not let it go. And finally, on like Christmas Eve, we had all the presents out. The wife was in bed and I was wide awake. I was like, forget it. I'm creating a stinking author page. So my mother-in-law, leave me alone. So they can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/David J. Kirshner author.
Okay.
So that J is just the middle initial, not spelled out. So,
okay.
And on that, what I do is I like to use notes on Facebook.
Okay.
As opposed to just putting some sort of stream of consciousness into a status update. You know, and because writing a note gives me greater latitude when it comes to how I want the text to look, because I'm very, you know, kind of controlling in that way because I'm a writer. So you'll find all kinds of stuff on there from, you know, hey, earlier this week I posted a new note with a YouTube link in it because I built a potato planter.
Oh, nice.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I got a friend of mine down in Texas who shipped me a bunch of her heirloom seed potatoes. Yeah. And so I was like, well, you know, I've got limited garden space, so I built this cedar planter that's about it's in an L shape, so it's 72 by 72 roughly. So it'll wrap around my existing raised planter. And so I took pictures as I was building it and made a YouTube video out of it.
Good.
Cool.
So you'll find that on Facebook. And so you'll all kinds of random stuff on there because, you know, I got undiagnosed ADHD.
Well, hey, as that potato plant continues to grow, as it starts popping out and starts getting some good growth and straight up and down, if you continue to mulch around the outside of it and kind of up and up and up, it'll start building and producing more potatoes.
Above the soil.
Yeah, basically above the soil line.
In the mulch.
So you might try that.
Yeah.
Well, what I did is I built it so that the back sides of the L are 4 fence pickets tall. So that's about 24 inches. And then the inside of the L, which is where the sunlight's going to be coming in, I only built that 2 pickets tall, which is about 12 inches. So I can fill that with dirt. And then as the plants grow, I was going to mound up more dirt, add a new slat of wood, plant grow, add more dirt, add the 4th slat so that by the time I was done, it was about 1.5 yards of dirt and about 2 dozen different potato plants. I might have been going overboard with that one. But,
well, cool. It'll be a good experiment.
It will. Yeah, you know what would be a really good experiment? If you did some of them with dirt and some of them with mulch.
Just use mulch.
Just mulch. Yeah. Just a mulching, straw.
Or any type of mulch, wood chips.
Or wood chips or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah, try it.
Maybe do an experiment. Yeah, just take a couple of plants.
All right, I'll do one side of the L with dirt and the other side with mulch. I did learn we had a lot of rain in the spring last year. And for unknown reasons, I planted my squash plants, and I mounded up half of them. I have no idea why. I just did it. And the other one, I just left, flush with the ground, like I always do. And we had so much rain that after 1 month, the ones that I didn't mound that were just flush with the ground, they were almost the exact same size as the day I planted them.
Yeah.
And the ones that I mounded up were already producing fruit, and the squash and zucchini were already, growing.
Yeah, I like that well-drained soil.
More drainage.
Yeah, I had never done it before. Nobody had ever told me to do it. I didn't read about it anywhere. I just was like, I'm going to mound this up.
Cool.
And, and it worked, and it was completely trial by error. So now, this year, when I, on March 1st, I start all of my seeds indoors under my grow lights. And they've got their little heat mats, and, everybody's happy. And then, where I'm located, we can't really plant until mid to late May. So that gives them about 2 months, 2.5 months of good growth before I transplant them and put them in the ground. So I usually get a good jump ahead of some neighbors who, they're going to go buy something at Lowe's or Home Depot. Or something.
Right.
I'm like, I'm growing my own.
Cool.
I know,
That's awesome.
I know where my dirt came from. I know what fertilizers I'm using. I know my seeds came from, rareseeds.com or My Patriot Supply, or I harvested them myself. So I know the sourcing of every single thing that's going in my garden.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's cool.
And I think that's a good place for a lot of people to start that are thinking about, either, homesteading or, just buying a piece of land and doing some jungle gardens or, terrace gardens, whatever it is that they want to do, start small.
Yep.
Learn how to grow a tomato in a pot on your back porch.
Yeah.
You don't need to go rent a tiller and the sod cutter and, tear up your whole backyard and put in a quarter acre garden if, you've never grown a green bean.
Yeah.
You need to start small. And that's kind of the advice I give to a lot of people that ask, questions when I go to conventions and I see people out and they're like, what kind of advice would you give somebody who's just starting out? And it's always, you need to do a self-assessment.
Yeah.
you need to, whatever it is that you think that you need to be prepared for, whether that's, an asteroid.
That's hard to prepare for.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Same thing with the Yellowstone caldera. Everybody's kind of screwed on that one.
Right.
Yeah.
But if it's an EMP, a financial collapse, a viral pandemic, a food system collapse, whatever it is you think that you need to be prepared for, whether, it could be something just as unemployment.
Yeah.
It could be a weather, like I live in an area that has a lot of power outages. What you need to do is do an honest self-assessment. Do you have the skills necessary to do X, Y, Z?
Yep.
No? Okay. Start taking some classes. Go ask some questions. Go read some books. Go try a few things on your own. If you're gonna live a homesteading lifestyle, is there even a shelter out there where you just bought that property? Are you going to grab a FEMA trailer on your way out? Do you have water? Do you have some way to get water, either to collect it or to drill for it or, whatever? Do you know how to use an inverter so that you can harness solar and store that into, a battery bank and use the inverter to actually draw the electric, do you know what a wiring diagram is, and So whatever it is that you think you want to do to address your deficiencies, you need to know at least where to start, and that starts with a self-assessment. So
yeah, I totally agree with that. It's always a good place to start.
I find all kinds of blueprints online, and I wish electricity didn't just scare the heck out of me. I really do.
Yeah.
You know, I can build you a $1 million home, but I am not sticking around to pull wire and run electricity, because it, I mean, I've been shocked too many times, and I'm like, forget it. I'm out. And I read so much, you know, I really want to learn all about electricity, but I read these electricity books and electronics and wire diagrams, and I'm like, the wiring in my head just does not connect. So
yeah, but that's my weak point too. Electricity and plumbing, although I've been getting into plumbing.
You've been doing
a
lot of plumbing projects lately.
Hey man, just remember, stuff runs downhill.
Yep. Exactly. Well, once again, Dave, thanks for being with us today. We really appreciate your time, and we enjoy your books, and looking forward to seeing what you have coming up in the future.
No, I look forward to it. You can call anytime.
Okay, will do. Take care now.
All right.
Our verse for today comes from Matthew chapter 18, verse 20. For where two or three are gathered in my name, there am I among them. And our shout out for today goes to Russ in California. Thanks for listening.